46. The giant dinosaurs resolve as we gallop closer. They're duck-billed, but far larger than I'd ever imagined. Unlike the Apalachio, these behemoths have no feathers. Their thick, wrinkled skin, like that of a rhino, is gray with black smudges. Not quite spots, not quite stripes. In the shadows of a thick forest, it would make clever camouflage. Not that they need it. I doubt there is much hunting them. At least I hope there isn't. Walking on all fours, their weight is dispersed, but the ground shakes beneath the herd like a constant low-grade earthquake. They're oblivious to the structures in town, scratching themselves against building corners and tasting metal surfaces. They're a rowdy bunch, their deep resounding bellows like foghorns. What I can only assume are the males bump into each other on occasion, snapping at their neighbors and slapping their long tails. While their grandstanding macho behavior might help them woo the larger females, their indifference to the town's presence means it's taking a beating. Walls crumble as tails whip back and forth. A few buildings are nearly flattened. I wonder how until I see one male headbutt another in the side, toppling him into a storefront, which folds inward. Black Creek is under assault, and soon there will be nothing left. I'm relieved I don't hear gunfire. Bullets and buckshot might just enrage the beasts. Right now, they're just passing through. No need to start a war. But the duckbills have clearly demonstrated that living in a traditional town during the Cretaceous might be impossible. Like all living things in this time, we might need to become nomadic, capable of moving, running, or fighting at a moment's notice. Cassie slows the horse as we approach the ruined outskirts of town. It looks like the dinosaurs all but charged down Main Street, funneled by the buildings. I don't see any bodies among the debris. The townspeople no doubt heard and felt the herd's approach. The lack of bodies is a relief, but the assault isn't over yet. We shouldn't get any closer, I say, and Cassie brings the horse to a stop. Don't want to spook them. If the herd becomes a stampede, they'd trample the small town to dust. Look, Cassie says, pointing toward the herd's core. For a moment, all I can see is long dinosaur legs and swishing tails. Then I see a group of people, five in total, comically small among the behemoths. What are they doing? I ask, as they run through the herd, narrowly avoiding being crushed. The dinosaurs either don't notice the small creatures among them or simply don't see them as a threat. They show no reaction to the presence of people, other than indifference. We watch in silence as the small group reaches the center of the overgrown street, and one by one they disappear into the ground. They're retreating to the tunnels, Cassie says. Won't be much of a town to stage an ambush from, I note, and after seeing these things, I doubt anyone feels safe above ground. I realize that Synergy's maze of tunnels and the facility atop the mountain will likely become our home and the birthplace of humanity on Earth. But will that change the future? With 100 million years between us and the first ape-like pre-humans, an entire civilization of people could come and go in a self-made apocalypse with barely a millimeter in the geological record as evidence. Modern human civilization didn't begin until 6,000 years in my presence past, and we're already nearly on the brink of wiping ourselves out. If we do, we'll have barely put a razor-thin line in the timeline of history. When a second group hurries outside and into the tunnels, I wonder if my father and Owen have already made the trip. Was this my father's idea? Or did Flores take over upon his return? Assuming he did return. I get an answer when a group of six horses breaks away from the backside of town and gallops toward us through the field. Flores is in the lead, followed by Enola and Levi. I'm not thrilled to see my father, with Owen on the saddle in front of him, following close behind. A horse with no rider brings up the rear. My replacement ride. Kuzneski is leading the people underground, Levi says, slowing to a trot and circling us. They'll wait there until we come back for them. You know what those things are? Cassie asks, pointing to the creatures clumsily destroying our town. Big ass asaurus? He shrugs. I ain't no paleontologist. They're hips abima. Pretty much all we knew about them was that they were big plant eaters. I think big assosaurus is more descriptive. How do you say big ass in Latin? Magnum asinus, Flora says, coming to a stop. Then he turns to me. Glad to see you made it. Wouldn't have without some prehistoric help, I say. And? Cassie gives me a sidelong glance. A very stubborn... The sentence trails off when I realize I was about to say girlfriend. On one hand, it's rather presumptuous. The stage of our relationship has just begun. But she's also so much more than a girlfriend. And yet, not my wife. My father and Owen's arrival spares me from having to finish. When they come to a stop in front of us, I vent my frustration at my father. You shouldn't be here. I know you're an adult, but you're still my son. Didn't sit well with me letting you face danger without having your back. Dad. I'm touched by his concern. I've been desperate for it most of my life. But at the moment, it's misplaced. If he had seen what I just had. I motion to Owen. You have to take him back.
I'd find a way out if you left me,
Owen says. We started this together. We'll see it through together. Bold words from an 11-year-old. They leave me a bit stymied. I don't remember being this stubborn, my father says. Forthright, Cassie adds, like she remembers this side of me well. Stupid, I say.
Well, maybe you've got a shitty memory, too,
Owen says, then turns to my father and raises an index finger to silence him.
We are lost in time and dinosaurs are destroying our town. I can damn well say shitty.
My father smiles, despite everything my young self said being true. Look, my father says, the McCoys stick together. And you'll be all right if we die together, I ask, because that's something McCoys also historically do. Owen, Cassie says, nudging me. Jeez. So long as we go down fighting, my father says, revealing his own stubborn streak. Memories of things that will never come to pass flit through my mind. Whispers at the wake and funeral, hushed stories at school. My father didn't die in the first cave-in. He died because he refused to evacuate. He died trying to rescue people. I've been given a second chance at life, right? My father says. I'm not going to waste it sitting by while people I love are in danger. It's what got you killed the first time, I say, sliding down from Cassie's horse. I'm surprised when my father slides down from his, standing eye to eye with me. He puts his hands on my shoulders. And you don't think that has anything to do with the kind of man you've become? I've seen you risk your life a number of times, and not just for loved ones. Life is precious. You know that better than most, I reckon. I learned it when your mother passed. You remember that old cross-stitch hanging beside the bathroom door? I nod. It's still there, made by a mother I never knew. Greater love has no one than this. My father waits for me to finish. To lay down one's life for one's friends, I say.
Or his family,
Owen says, looking down at me from his mount.
That last bit isn't in the good book, but there's no one as flesh and blood as you and me, except for all the other folks with doubles in town, I suppose. But they're not here, so
Don't push it, Owen, my father grumbles.
Point is,
Owen says, get over it, we're here. We're all here, Cassie says, for better or worse. That she's co-opted traditional marriage vows into her contribution doesn't go unnoticed by anyone except for her.
What?
She asks.
As much as this moment is tugging at my heartstrings,
Levi says,
I reckon we should make like the Hebrews in Egypt and get the fuck out.
He turns to my father.
Sorry.
Then he points into the distance.
Because, you know, him.
The moment Levi points, my stomach sours. His finger extends in the direction from which Cassie and I have just fled. My father and I mount our horses and turn them around. Standing in a line, we gaze out over the golden field cast in the dull light of a sun below the horizon. Just outside the distant forest, Sewell Kalu runs toward us at a confident pace. Everything about him says, I'm going to catch you, kill you, skin you, and wear you. Worse, his body appears to have healed. His insides have been stuffed back in place, and aside from the dark purple stains on the skins he's already wearing, there is no evidence that he was injured. Part of me says to retreat to the tunnel's safety. That would protect us from the hunter, but do nothing to help us with our larger problems. And fighting Sewell Kalu isn't an option. Our best bet is to outrun him, beat him to synergy, and make him Langdon's problem, something the old man has been trying to avoid since the beast showed up.
So, Levi says, what's the plan?
I turn to face Adele, her tall peak still bathed in the orange glow of day. We chase the light. With a solid kick, my horse breaks toward the mountain, and the others follow close behind. It's going to be a hard run over steep terrain, overrun with animals from the future to the Cretaceous.
I have no illusions about it being safe or easy, but I seriously doubt that there is anything ahead of us that's worse than what's behind.